Hello and welcome into the Polite Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Page. Welcome back for season two. We had a successful first season, and then we had to take a break because I relocated out to Washington, D.C. For school and also got married. So life got pretty busy out here, but excited to be out here and excited to be back on. We've got a slightly new format for you, but my guest today, Governor Gary Herbert, governor of the great state of Utah. He'll be on in a bit to talk a little bit about the state and what's working and what's not. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk slightly about a couple programming notes. First, we have a slightly new format. We're going to go a little shorter. I'm sure that will break your hearts, but we're going to go a little bit shorter. Just do two segments instead of three. We'll have a news segment and then either an in-depth interview or an in-depth review of a topic. So one or the other gives us a little more flexibility to cover things based on what's going on in the world. The second thing, last season we talked a lot about Hillary Clinton's emails. And the truth is, it's a big story. At the time she was the presumed incoming president of the United States, she was leading all the polls. That's changed a little, although she's still very high up there among the Democrats and competitive in a general election setting. But if I cover that, it's pretty much the only thing we're going to cover every week. And so she has scheduled testimony on October 22nd before the House Benghazi Committee. And I think that's going to cover a lot of things. So after that, we will do one big episode talking about Hillary's emails. And then if additional truths come to light, additional facts come to light, we will discuss those at that time. But I'm going to take a break from Hillary's emails for a couple weeks. So if you're here for Hillary's emails, just hold tight. It's going to be a couple weeks, okay? Now, news this week. We have three big stories I want to address. The first is that Speaker John Boehner, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, announced that he is stepping down. Republicans are currently choosing new House leadership. This vote is happening this week, this upcoming week, and it's getting a little tense. It seemed like Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, so the number two among the Republicans, was just going to move up. There are two other Republicans who potentially could have had that job for sure and didn't want it. The first is Paul Ryan. He is running the budget committee in the House, and he was, of course, Mitt Romney's running mate in 2012. The other is Trey Gowdy. He's a South Carolina lawmaker who has done a lot on oversight and is chairing the House Benghazi Committee. Both of them said they have no interest in doing it. Now, Utah's Jason, well, I should say before that, Kevin McCarthy made a gaffe talking about the Benghazi Committee. He talked about it in a lot of context and how it was doing good work, but then made a statement that mentioned that it was politically hurting Hillary Clinton, and the information it had learned had hurt Hillary Clinton. And Democrats seized on that and have tried to paint that as saying the entire Benghazi committee is just a political exercise, and I'll let you decide what you think about that. But as a result, Republicans are saying we need someone who can message well and can represent the face of Republicans in Congress. And so there's some concern there. Now, Jason Chaffetz, who's on that Benghazi committee and who runs the oversight committee, he's from Utah, actually my home representative. I am still a Utahn, and he is my home representative, is running, just announced, or he's testing the waters as I'm recording this on Saturday, that he could potentially run as a long shot to replace McCarthy. It's possible. Chaffetz is smart to do it because he's going to raise his profile either way. And if McCarthy wins, I can't imagine him trying to take revenge on Chaffetz because the Tea Party wing of the conference would go nuts. So that leads me to story number two, which also has to do with Mr. Chaffetz, which is that the Secret Service has been scandal-plagued for the last few years. You may have seen sketches on Jon Stewart. You may have seen it in a host of other areas, but they have had a lot of problems. They've had agents caught with drugs, with prostitutes, And they've done poor protection of the president. They had bullet holes found in the White House that were not discovered till a few days after they were shot from the street. I mean, really scary stuff. So the Oversight Committee's been going after that, and Jason Chaffetz has been on that. Well, the Secret Service took some private records of Jason Chaffetz, and they're nothing particularly embarrassing, but that he had looked at serving in the Secret Service and had applied, and have disclosed it to try and embarrass him. And that is a huge violation of law and a huge violation of integrity. And the fact that they would do that is really problematic. Here's the worst part. 18 leaders in the Secret Service who are under the head of the department knew about it. And not only did they do nothing, they didn't tell the head of the department, or so he claims. Now look, I doubt firings are coming. But Republicans have loudly condemned this, and some Democrats have a little more quietly condemned it. This is a nonpartisan issue, and it's one that's becoming an increasing problem. Our government needs to create serious penalties to any government employee who is disclosing private information about individuals. And especially when there's a motivation like this, it probably needs to be a very serious penalty. But I'll leave it to you to say what that is. But this is becoming a serious problem. And the lack of faith in the Justice Department that I think a lot of us have is fueling that frustration. Now, that leads me to the last issue, which is the shooting in Oregon at Umpqua Community College. Obviously, this is the most important of the stories of the week, but I wanted to build up to it last because some of the elements of these last stories I think are going to play into understanding it. The first is, as of this recording, there are 10 people who are dead, and that is a tragedy. We have numerous reports that the shooter was targeting Christians. He asked people to stand, state their religion. Christians were killed, non-Christians were shot in the legs or let go. We don't have all the details yet. Now, I want to caution anyone from getting too ridiculous on this. Here are two issues I want to talk about. The first is common sense on bigotry and killings, and the second is the gun control discussion. On bigotry and killings, okay, we have somebody who, over the summer, remember we had a racist who attacked a black church and killed a number of people. This is similar, and that led to a discussion of the Confederate flag and other things. So here's my common sense on the subject. First, because this person appeared to be motivated by bigotry toward Christians. First, promoting bigotry is wrong. But, and this is important, people who say hurtful things are not responsible for murder. Saying something hurtful and murdering someone are two different things. If a black person is killed, the person who killed that black for racial reasons, if a white person kills a black person for racial reasons, that white person is responsible for doing it. But other groups who say things that might be tangentially racist, while they're doing something immoral in saying that, are not responsible for murder. Similarly, media entities and others who have promoted hate against Christians are not responsible for this murder. Should they rethink their language? Absolutely. Should they rethink their worldview and the way they're portraying it? Absolutely, but they're not responsible for that. I think this is probably a good chance to reflect on how the media talks about issues. Just as the shooting at the African American church was a great opportunity to revisit a discussion of some symbols of racism that we seem to keep very publicly. Now, the American left needs to eat some crow here because it tries to politicize these things. Whenever a murder happens, not only on guns, but when Gabrielle Giffords, who's a member of Congress, was shot, the left-wing pundits and others tried to blame Sarah Palin because she had put out an ad with a target on it, and it was listing all the targets for people they didn't want in the House. It was completely acceptable behavior there, but they tried to blame her. They've tried to do a lot of things that way, and so they need to eat a bit, little bit of crow here, because there was bigotry. It was motivated by the type of anti-Christian vitriol that is coming out of a lot of left-wing institutions today. However, conservatives who stood up for Sarah Palin ought to stand back up here and say, you know what? No, this isn't the right way to handle it, and we shouldn't be going down this road. The second point I want to make on this is that there is an inevitable gun control discussion, and we of course have it at the worst possible time whenever a shooting occurs. President Obama gave some remarks, and the money quote from the speech was that we should politicize this. There is a concern about mass murders in our society, and while they are an incredibly small fraction of the murders that happen, there is a concern about it. Democrats feel that gun control would solve the problem. Republicans feel that allowing concealed carry on college campuses would solve it. The places where mass murders are happening, in a lot of cases, are places where guns aren't allowed on campus. So, people can have their opinions on those things, and I think ultimately where things get problematic is that neither of those things completely solves the problem, if it solves the problem at all. And I'll leave it to you to have that debate, and we can have a gun control discussion the other day. But I wanted to give you the news and kind of give you a heads up on where this is going. There's a gun control discussion coming in our country, and we'll get to that in another section. Well, I would say the American left is constantly trying to push a gun control discussion after every one of these crises. Hasn't really happened yet, or to the extent that it hasn't resulted in policy change. One idea that has lost traction, and this goes back to the previous issue, is the idea for a national registry. Right now we have background checks. There are a handful of Democrats call them loopholes, Republicans just call them common sense elements of that. So right now, if you buy a gun from a commercial dealer, there is a background check associated with that. But, and this is the exception, if you buy it in a private sale, so it's not a gun dealer, your parents give you a gun, or you inherit a gun. You inherit a gun from somebody or something like that. That's not subject to a background check. Some have called that the gun show loophole because gun shows, sales that happen at gun shows are usually private transactions. The other discussion is this notion of a national registry. And liberals have called for a national gun registry in the United States that would track every gun. There's a couple issues with this. First is that they actually tried to implement this in Canada and failed. But the second thing that I think is problematic is this disclosure of private information. We have an increasing number of stories of government employees disclosing private information for a variety of reasons. We had information about Mitt Romney's charitable donations leaked during the presidential campaign. We had, there is an investigation ongoing right now because a member of the White House leaked the Kochs. Remember, the Kochs are the billionaire industrialists who donate a lot to Republicans. It sounds like a member of the White House team, I believe he was on the Council of Economic Advisors, had some of the Kochs' private taxpayer information and was giving it to reporters, information he couldn't have gotten any other way, and so there's an investigation ongoing there. And now this story with Jason Chaffetz. The concern with a national gun registry is twofold. First, there are some who fear simply that the government will use it to target people. But the second, and I think this is one that people feel a little more strongly, is that that information could be leaked to allow citizens to target people who own firearms. And that seems problematic. And until the government is able to protect information and properly punish government employees who abuse their power to steal people's information and share that, I don't see that getting any traction anywhere. Well, that's the news of the week. Coming up, we have Governor Gary Herbert. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back in a weekly format. Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Do you disagree with something I said? You're probably not alone. Shoot me an email at tpage@politepolitics.com, and if you make a good point, I'll read it on the air. My guest today is the governor of the great state of Utah. Welcome to the podcast, Gary Herbert. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Tyler. It's an honor to be with you today.
Awesome. You know, Governor, I think you're probably the only qualified Republican not running for president. You must like your job.
Well, you know, I've been elected as the incoming chairman of the National Governors Association, and people do ask me, how did you get that honor? And I've thought about it, and I've come to the conclusion that it's because I am the only governor not running for president, so I'm available to take on the responsibility. I actually know that most all the governors running wish they had the track record of Utah as part of their resume, because Utah really is performing better than any other state in America today on virtually every measurable area, particularly economically. We have the fourth most diversified economy. We're the number one job creator in America today. Unemployment rate is down to 3.4%, third lowest in the nation. We're a fast-growing state that has a great quality of life and listed as the best place for business for the last 5 years by Forbes magazine. I could go on and waste all of your time here by telling you all the great things about Utah, but it's something to be grateful for. We have great people that call Utah home, and clearly, by their fruits, you shall know them. We're performing at a very, very high level in Utah today.
Well, tell me a little bit, I was going to get into that later, but I'm curious, why is that? What is it about Utah? What's happened here over the last 10, 15, 20 years that have created that?
Well, everything's done in comparison. So Utah compared to the other 49 states and the rest of the world, for that matter. And what we find in Utah is that we have really good people. You can imagine being the coach of a football team, and you might be the best coach in the history of football, but if you don't have good players, if you don't have good running backs, a good quarterback, defensive line, people that can pass and catch the football, you might have a difficult time winning games. So it starts with having really good players. And in Utah, we are blessed with really good people, really good players. And not just me saying, I actually met with the Pew Center here a couple years back who asked me, why Utah? What is the secret of the success of Utah? And I met with them for an hour and a half, and they ended up saying, well, you just have better people in Utah. So we really do have good people, and that's the foundation. The second thing is, with good people, we have a good game plan. We really do have good policies in place that empower the private sector, that help the economy to be healthy. It venerates the entrepreneur, the risk taker, the wealth creators out there. And that's why people are coming to Utah to, in fact, start their business or to grow their business. That's why we have entrepreneurs that are just thriving here, that start their business here in Utah and are Utahns. I had an economic development summit. We had four people on the panel, all having companies worth over $1 billion that have been started in the last decade, all from Utah County.
Yeah.
One area of our state. Again, a good example that we've got rules in place and an environment that's conducive to the entrepreneur and the business, the risk taker, the wealth creator. And on top of that, we have really good labor force. Our labor force is unique in that it's young. Our median age in Utah is 29.2 years of age. It's very technologically advanced. We have the highest percentage of home computer use in America here in Utah. So we're technologically engaged and involved and understand the blessing of new technologies to make us more effective and efficient. We also have a good culture of work. Our production per man hour here in Utah is as good as any place in America, and better than most every place in America. And so when you get pay somebody for an honest day's work, with an honest day's pay, you get an honest day's work. So our production is very good here. We don't have the absenteeism. We have people that show up on time and leave on time. So a very productive workforce. And we are bilingual. We speak 130 languages here in Utah, and that gives us entree to the world in ways that most states can only envy. So as our economy is growing here and throughout America, it's also growing with help from international trade because we speak so many different languages here in Utah, and again, by far more than any other state in America. So those things, with a good culture we have of good principles and values, is really just a recipe for success economically, providing a great quality of life, and that's why we are virtually the envy of the rest of the country.
Definitely. I actually got my start at one of those billion-dollar companies. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah. I started at Qualtrics years ago.
Well, the Smith family is doing a wonderful job of expanding their company now worldwide, and valued over $1 billion. And the interesting thing is whether it's the original WordPerfect, you know, and Signetics way before your time and other technology, you know, as they've grown and developed, there's been spinoffs. As they've been bought and divided, you know, there's been more spinoffs. And the economy of Utah has expanded exponentially because of all these original entrepreneurs, but now they've spawned 6 or 8 different companies with other people at their head, creating jobs and opportunity. So it's just a great system, the free market capitalistic system we have here in America, which is being kind of lost in other parts of our country and embrace more of a socialistic approach, but not in Utah.
Yeah.
Utah really still has upward mobility in a greater degree than any place in America and probably any place in the world. And that's not just me speaking. That was an article here last year in the New Yorker magazine that said upward mobility in Utah is alive and well.
Well, I'm curious, you mentioned being the chair of the Republican Governors Association.
It's actually the National Governors Association.
Excuse me, National Governors.
It's the bipartisan. It's Republicans and Democrats. 31 Republicans, okay. By the way, in the NGA. So there's the majority there, but it's bipartisan.
Well, that's a powerful room of people. I'm curious, and Utah has received acclaim for a lot of the conservative accomplishments you mentioned, but also some that, I mean, I've seen bits on Jon Stewart praising how Salt Lake is ending homelessness. Mm-hmm. Certainly the gay rights religious freedom bill gained a lot of acclaim. I'm curious, how do you go to that governor's meeting and say, here's how you can replicate us? Or is Utah's culture so different that it's just not doable?
Well, it's a great question, Tyler, and people are puzzled. You know, they wonder, how can this smallish state where, 3 million people, nestled here at the foot of the Rocky Mountains, how can we have such great success in virtually every measurable way? And we're receiving accolades from just around the world about, look at Utah. I was once to a Chamber of Commerce meeting, and they asked me to come and speak on an issue, and I was waiting in the wings, and the professor that was speaking talked in terms of, here's some ideas to the states of how they can improve, whether it be health care, how they can improve education, how they can improve infrastructure needs economically, different issues he's talking about, and he had some suggestions. And invariably he'd say, well, they're already doing this in Utah. Or he'd talk about something else, say, you know, that I learned this from Utah. And he'd talk a little longer, and he'd say, now Utah's already experimenting with this concept. It just leads me to understand that Utah has been a leader in so many ways. We do think outside the box. We do have a common sense approach. It's based on conservative principles when it comes to the government. We live within our means. We don't spend more than we take in. We do not have unreasonable debt. We do empower the private sector. We have regulation reform, so the regulations don't get in the way of the business entrepreneur. We have competitive tax rates. We're in the top 10 lowest when it comes to tax liability. So if you want to look at a state to live in that you don't have an ordinate amount of taxes you have to pay, Utah is in the top 10 of that. So all those things work together to make this a very business-friendly environment. And if you've got a good economy, it's not hard to have a good quality of life. Now, we're blessed with a beautiful state, a lot of outdoor recreational opportunities, a healthy lifestyle, happy, optimistic people. Number one by polling that we're the happiest and most optimistic people in America. That makes a very conducive place to live. And people understand that. They feel it. They sense it. And that's why people want to be here with us, and business people in particular. So it's really a matter of bringing conservative principles and having a common sense approach to it, religious liberties, anti-discrimination, know, we just brought a common sense approach, and we said, hey, we're going to work together on this. And we didn't have one bill competing with another bill. We had one bill that combined both interests of anti-discrimination for the gay community and put in there also anti-discrimination for those of religious persuasion. And at the end of the day, probably both sides didn't get all that they wanted, but we also came together so that everybody was supported what we had. And we didn't have the fallout that you saw in other states that tried to thread the needle and were not successful at doing it. So again, it's kind of the conservative, common sense approach of Utah.
I'm curious, you mentioned the trade-offs there. One of the things we talk about on the podcast all the time is that that's how most policy working works, right? There are trade-offs. Every dollar spent one place can't be spent another place, regardless of taxes and all that. I'm curious, how do you make that decision? Because as the governor, you don't get to write legislation per se. You're certainly going to have an influence down on the Hill, or I guess in the building here. But how do you decide when you're looking at legislation? Maybe there's 90% good and a little bit bad. How do you deal with that?
Well, I try not to think in terms of trade-offs. I think in terms of let's get the problem identified and then let's solve the problem as best we can. There's no perfect way to solve problems, or maybe more than one way to skin the cat. So what we've done with the Herbert administration has become very proactive in working with the legislature. You'll notice that I probably have not had to veto a lot of bills. Veto a number of bills each session, it seems like. But the reason we've not had to do that is because we've worked with the legislators and said, here's where we have a concern. If you continue down that road, it may rise to the level of a veto. We say to them, the concept and principles we agree with, but some of the details maybe need to be reworked. And so we work very proactively to help steer legislation so that it's passed and voted on, and we have a good bill when it comes out that has no need to be vetoed, and we have no need to trade off. So with legislation, we're very proactive, and it's worked very well. I've said before, you know, we're all on the same team. I have a different role as executive branch than the legislature does, but let's work together to solve problems. And if we'll keep our eye on that, you know, what's the problem and how do we solve it, we usually will come together without having to have much trade-off. Budgetary issues sometimes are a little different. If you're going to put so much money into roads, it may take away some money you could put into some health and human service needs. We believe in the safety net that Ronald Reagan talked about, and so there are people who are most vulnerable amongst us that need a little helping hand, and government can extend that helping hand. We're trying to do it in a way, though, that empowers the individual to take on responsibility and to get out of government assistance, and we think that's the proper principle. But as we spend money and decide, okay, there's only a finite amount of dollars, where should we spend it to get the best bang for the taxpayer's dollar and the best outcome, you have to kind of prioritize. And sometimes your priority may be different than another one's. Executive may be different than the legislature. The legislature itself might have different priorities amongst the body. And so sometimes there comes some trade-offs, if that's the right term, as far as how you balance the budget and prioritize correctly to how you spend the dollars. So that's probably the only trade-off that we really have that we talk much about.
Okay. Well, Governor, thank you so much. My last question is my favorite question that I ask everybody in politics.
What's that?
I feel like what I find is everybody gets in for a reason or there's something they want to do. You obviously have had quite a few accomplishments. The state's running very well and has received that acclaim nationwide. But whenever your political career ends, what is the one biggest accomplishment you want to have? Is there one thing that you say, I want this?
Well, that's a tough question because I haven't really thought about, you know, what that would be. I mean, it's like saying, what's your legacy going to be and what do you want to have people remember you as and for? I got involved in politics mainly because I was angry. I had a very successful real estate business. The marketplace really was crumbling around me, and a lot of assets I had were being squandered and lost. And I'd been involved in some lobbying efforts for real estate, small business in Washington, D.C., and here at the Capitol on a volunteer basis. And And I got angry that finally somebody said, well, why don't you do something about it besides just talking? And they challenged me to run for office. And really, I was angry enough at the time that I did it. And my wife has never forgiven me for that. But anyway, that's how I got involved. And really, I have no agenda from the standpoint of I'm trying to go someplace. I'm not running for president. You've mentioned that. I don't plan to go to Washington. I really love my state. I think Utah has a role to play as an example to the rest of the country. I think we have some unique opportunities to help turn the country around in a better direction than it's going now. And people are looking at Utah, and they are wondering why. Why is Utah doing so good? I know the reasons and the principles and the values, and I'm happy to share those. And I think the country will benefit by having a good example. So what drives me every day is I just want Utah to be the best it can possibly be. We set a goal when I came in 5 years ago to have Utah to become the best performing economy in America. And we added to that, and along with that, to be a premier global business destination. Pretty ostentatious goals. I mean, people say, are you crazy? We're at nearly 9% unemployment. We're at the depths of the Great Recession. And you want to become the best performing economy in America and a premier global business destination? You know, what is wrong with you? Nothing was wrong with me. I believe in goals. I believe we had potential. I believe we had opportunity. And the good news is for all of us that care about Utah and our future is for the last 4 months in a row, we have been the best performing economy in America. We're creating more jobs than any state in America at a higher rate than any state in America. So we've accomplished that goal. We've been named the best place for business by Forbes and others multiple times. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the best enterprising state in America. The New Yorker Magazine, no bastion of conservative thought, has said upward mobility in Utah is better than any place in America and better than any developed country in the world. So we've accomplished that goal. Right now, we are growing our international trade and import-export business better than any state in America. Over the last 5 years, our growth has been phenomenal. We have built-in advantage because, as I mentioned, we speak the world's languages. We have great entrepreneurs and business people who are trying to expand beyond the borders, and 95% of the customers of any business, if you look at the world, are outside the borders of America. So, again, an opportunity, and we've become that. Our goals that we set when I came into office, we've realized. Now, that's the good news, and I'm proud about that and grateful. The question now is, how do you continue to do it? How do you stay number one? It's like being the national champion in football. How do you repeat?
Yeah.
It's one thing to get there. Our challenge right now going forward is to continue to maintain our number one position and maybe even improve our performance outcomes and maybe have separation between us as number one and whoever's number two. But like one of the governors introduced me in Washington, D.C. here a few weeks ago, he said, let me introduce you to Gary Herbert, the governor of the state of Utah, which state has every other state in America in its rearview mirror. I like that. I like that.
Well, Governor, I think the national electorate's loss is Utah's gain, so we're glad to have you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much, Tyler.